Yeah. It's just like you. It's just that they think that they can kind of inoculate themselves against the charge of it being about skin color, and that just narrowly, like, none of us said anything about skin color. So, like, why are you saying that there's any?
There
kind
were
of
no
racism?
Calipers no, in this conference. Yeah. But I saw
everyone had to check their calipers at the door. Yeah.
This is you go through the metal detector, and they're not looking for guns; they're looking for calipers. I'm sure the guns were welcome.
Yeah, that was really jaunty.
Yeah. All right. Welcome, listeners, to episode 6 of Know Your Enemy. We're recording today at Know Your Enemy World Headquarters, otherwise known as my apartment. Mm-hmm. And I'm here. I'm Matt Sittman. I'm one of the podcast co-hosts. And I'm here with my friend Sam Adler-Bell.
Hi, Matt.
How are you doing today, Sam?
I'm fine.
Better than last time we
better
recorded?
Better than last time. Although, I don't think I was such a downer last time.
You weren't. I picked up the slack on
I've
that
got my
front.
Chemical levels balanced out. All
oh, good.
My prescriptions, both actually literally prescribed and those that I self-medicate.
What W.H. Auden called the chemical life.
Yeah, my chemical life is in order.
Good.
I'm ready to talk about national conservatism.
Yeah. And I'm just back from a vacation. I was out west for a week.
Yeah.
I was in Denver and I was in Moab, Utah hiking, and I saw the rodeo in Cheyenne.
Yeah, and Matt posted a lot of sexy beefy pics on what's the word?
On Insta?
Oh yeah, on Insta.
I'll accept sexy and beefy.
Yeah.
But I just thought of that because of the reference to chemicals, because there's some chemicals out in Denver too that you can get legally.
You can buy.
Yeah. There are pot shops everywhere.
Yeah.
It is striking.
Yeah, and it's the beginning of the end of liberal social order.
So we should begin, as we often do, with some housekeeping. One thing to mention is that we have a lot of new listeners. So our last episode was far and away the most popular. A lot of you have gone back and listened to older episodes, which is great. But we want to thank new listeners. We're grateful you're tuning in, so to speak. And many of you have rated and reviewed us on iTunes, which is great. And I do think that's part of how this is getting to new listeners, is that a lot of you have been generous with your comments and generous to take the time to rate it. So if you haven't, please do so.
Yeah, recommend it on Twitter.
Recommend us on Twitter, share it, tell your friends.
And your enemies.
And your enemies, yeah. But also, we did, after the last episode, start a Patreon.
Yeah.
Just to make us doing this more sustainable. Right now, it's just something Sam and I do, you know, in the nooks and crannies of our days and weeks.
Yeah.
Sam spends a lot of time editing the episodes. And normally when we record, we spend a lot of time together. We talk about it for a few hours beforehand. We record. We normally, you know, then talk about what worked or didn't work. So it's kind of an involved process, and we're grateful for the support. But, you know, Sam's looking a little pale, like he's not eating enough vegetables, or, you know, that he's subsisting on
hot dogs, hot pockets. No, I'm okay. But I'm so grateful for the people who have signed up for the Patreon already. It's not only something that I definitely need in order to justify doing this with a good chunk of my freelance writing time, but also it just encourages us that the podcast is, you know, worthwhile, worth people's expenditure of time and money. And so if you go on the Patreon, which is just patreon.com/knowyourenemy,
patreon.com/knowyourenemy,
yeah, you can see that there's different tiers, they have funny names. And, you know, if you happen to be independently wealthy, like, you can give as much money as you want. But the $5 level, at this moment, we haven't put anything, we haven't put any episodes behind a paywall. And we want to make sure that the meat and potatoes, like classic Know Your Enemy episodes, are in front of the paywall. You know, the stuff that we do a lot of preparation for, the things we read books and get together and do the full-length episodes. We're going to keep those in front of the paywall, but for those of you who are signing up for the Patreon, there will be bonus episodes And those can be, those will probably be shorter, they'll be looser, we'll be telling stories.
More personal.
Maybe just kind of shooting the shit about the news. So we're asking you to support us on the Patreon no matter what, because in order to keep doing this, we do need to do that. And that would also mean the audio quality, everything is better if we have more time and money to spend on it. But also, if you are signing up for the $5 level and you're like, well, what the hell am I going to get out of this? There will be bonus content. And it'll be fun if you like listening to Matt and me speak.
That's true. Many of the comments have remarked upon our rapport.
Yeah. I don't get it.
Yeah. I fucking hate Sam. I don't know what you people are hearing. That's why we drink when we record, so that we can stand each other.
Exactly. And Matt's face gets prettier as I drink more Coors, which is helpful.
Hi, this is Sam from the future, interjecting to say that in fact the first Patreon bonus episode will be available this week. It features three additional in-depth discussions we didn't have room for in this episode. Matt and I will dig deep on his former teacher and post-liberal critic Patrick Deneen, Rusty Reno, the editor of First Things, and the court jester of American fascism himself, Tucker Carlson. If you find you like this episode and you want more, sign up for the Patreon to get that good, good extra content. Now back to the show.
Right. So thank you again for everyone who is supporting us. There probably will be some other announcements about the podcast coming up, but they're not finalized yet and they don't involve money.
Yeah.
So nothing we've said will
change,
be superseded by any future announcements.
Matt is being oblique in the manner of a national conservative who's trying to hide the fact that they're actually a racist. there are some announcements to come.
So that's enough housekeeping. We want to get into the heart of this episode right away, because there's quite a bit to talk about.
Yep.
And the topic today is the National Conservatism Conference that was recently held in Washington, D.C. It happened about 2 weeks ago in mid-July. We're recording this toward the end of July. And it was, a conference on national conservatism at the Ritz-Carlton in Washington, sponsored by the Edmund Burke Foundation, a new dark money.
Isn't it like the case that we don't know where their money is coming from because they haven't had to submit a 990 yet?
That's true. Yes. So we will know more about their funding, but for now we don't know who funded this because of the timing of the paperwork when you start something like this. I have some guesses about where the money's coming from. I mean, Peter Thiel was a keynote speaker.
Yeah.
But to give a brief summary of it, it was a coming out party for the nationalist conservatism kind of school of thought that has developed, especially in the Trump era, since Trump has been elected. Some of the people who went to this conference and spoke at it were people who typically you would have thought of as mainstream movement conservatives. Others have been traditionally more associated with either paleoconservatism or more Trumpist or Pat Buchananite kind of approach to conservatism. And others still are, were more from the religious right, but are now talking more about nationalism. So we're talking about people like the real gurus of this seem to be, number one was Yoram Hazony, a kind of Israeli-American political theorist. He's probably most well-known recently for a book he wrote about nationalism called The Virtues of Nationalism.
Yeah.
Rusty Reno, R.R. Reno, who we talked about quite a bit last episode, who is the editor of First Things.
Yeah.
Dan McCarthy, who was formerly the editor of the American Conservative. Another person on the board is my old teacher at Georgetown, Joshua Mitchell. But speaking of old teachers, Patrick Deneen spoke. Peter Thiel was a keynote speaker. And very importantly, I think, from my perspective, and I think Sam agrees too, is Josh Hawley, the new senator from Missouri, gave us a keynote speech.
Yeah, which got some amount of attention.
Right.
He was the only elected politician there.
Correct.
That sort of is an indication of the fact that they do see him as the leading vessel for this set of ideas in Washington. Though there was another sort of vessel there, which was Tucker Carlson.
Yes.
Who's sort of the propaganda arm of this project insofar as there is a project. And yeah, I mean, obviously we're saying some of the same names. There's a lot of overlap with what we talked about last week about the post-liberal, illiberal right. There's Deneen was there. Rusty Reno was there. But we didn't get to talk that much last week about how important the nation state and nationalism is to this effort to provide intellectual scaffolding for Trumpism.
Right. And I think one way of putting it might be something like, not all anti-liberals are nationalist,
mm-hmm.
but most of these nationalists at least portray themselves as anti-liberal.
Right.
So last week when we were talking about the integralists, the kind of Catholic theocon types, whatever the limits of that term might be, I think a lot of them would actually be uncomfortable with the nationalism because they're good Catholics, or that's how they portray themselves, which means some of the integralists are very critical of the nationalist position on immigration, for
right.
example, or even a certain valorization of the nation state.
They're loyal to the Pope.
They're loyal to the Pope rather than the flag.
That's not a nationalist position.
Right. Again, one thing Sam and I try to do is be fair about all this. And I do want to just distinguish some of what we talked about last week with what we're talking about this week. And I think the integralists, some might be nationalists, but at least a number of them really don't take that position. So there are some overlap between the two episodes, between last episode and this one. And some like Rusty Reno and Deneen are...
connective tissue.
The connective tissue between the anti-liberalism and the nationalism. But the two terms are not totally able to be conflated. And this episode, we're going to talk more about nationalism as such and what happened at this conference. I mean, Sam and I have pored over these videos. if you're thinking about donating to the Patreon, you should do so just because we had to watch so many of these videos, so you don't have to.
Yeah, and one other thing I wanted to say is that, like, insofar as there is overlap between the sort of post-liberals that we talked about last week, this conference sort of gets at some of the stuff we were getting at the end of the episode, where we were talking about how is it that, you know, this set of ideas that are taking place in small circulation magazines ends up having anything to do with how, you know, politicians govern. But you see with this kind of, they're making it more respectable. Josh Hawley is there, like, there's a politician there. They're developing a way. This is kind of how what are, in some cases, like really radical, scary, illiberal ideas get smuggled into mainstream discourse is through conferences
right.
like this.
Yes. No, that's a really good point, Sam. I mean, you might think of every political movement in some ways as having three elements: principles, popularizers, and politicians.
Mm-hmm.
And all three were represented at this conference. You
right.
had the political theorists, the academics, you had someone like Tucker Carlson, and then you had a politician like Josh Hawley, a United States senator.
Yeah.
So you can see how ideas kind of take shape and then become actualized and put forth on the right. And they're really good at it. There was a lot of agreement, but there was some disagreement. It's
yeah.
not like this was just pure propaganda meant
right.
to... You know, it wasn't like everyone was on the exact same page.
No, that's true.
And so they get people in a room, but it makes everyone in that room kind of buy into the idea that at least they need to wrestle with these ideas. And it's also a way of, I think, identifying what these people have in common.
Yeah.
So going forward, like, what parts of a political program would be the most palatable and which parts then might be the areas where they back off from because it might be too controversial within the coalition. Now, I did want to add one thing that I didn't say last episode about how these ideas catch on. And that is, all this is happening, too, against a backdrop of our both sides media.
Yeah.
So what happens is, if you have a bunch of respectable conservatives at the Ritz-Carlton talking about nationalism, and it's
yeah.
covered in the New York Times and BuzzFeed and Vox and the Washington Post,
yeah.
and to say nothing of a million other columns and
yeah.
Sort of opinion pieces about what happened.
Ross Douthat wrote his column about it. So, like, it was covered in the New York Times multiple times. Right.
So I guess when you think about the fact that the conservative movement is a relatively, it is still more cohesive, which is not to say there aren't differences among conservatives, but institutionally and programmatically, it's a relatively small world. And if you can get ideas taken seriously in that world, that automatically means, given the both sides nature of our media,
mm-hmm.
that nationalism is being written about in the New York Times. It becomes part of the terms of debate,
yeah.
is what I'm trying to say. And it happens very easily and quickly because of the nature of the right combined with the pathologies of our media.
Yeah. And they did a good job of presenting it in its sort of, I mean, not all of them. The mask slipped a few times, but they did try to present it in such a way that you could imagine the New York Times and Washington Post articles where they say, well, yeah, sure, Trump is a racist nationalist, and that's clear. But maybe there's something to these ideas, right? Like, look at these like well-dressed academics and think tankers who are having this conversation about nationalism, and they're not talking about race. And in fact, like, they were explicitly against the race-based nationalism. We're going to talk more about how A, sincere that is, or how meaningful it is.
Right. Like, for example, David Brog, who's one of the main organizers, he gave a, you know, just a 10-minute opening talk, sort of welcome. But he said explicitly, if you're a white nationalist or you're a racist, there's the door.
Right.
Show yourself out right now.
So who's that really for? I mean, it's not for the people. I mean, the people in the room, whether or not they have any sympathy for that idea, they're not going to get up and walk out.
Right. Especially after they paid that entrance fee.
Very expensive, yeah. But it's for the media in the room. I mean, the New York Times gets to hear, okay, these aren't the white nationalists.
And that got repeated over and over.
Yeah.
It's a fig leaf. But the other thing I would say is, and Sam kind of hinted at this or intimated it, I think this conference really was about mainstreaming the nationalist school of thought.
Yeah.
Because if you look at some of the people who were there, a guy like Yuval Levin, even someone like Rusty
Reno,
who's at AEI and had been a kind of long time, kind of in the neoconservative orbit. He edits the journal National Affairs, just a journeyman on the right for a long time. You have people like that who you would not have associated with Trump. You would not have associated with nationalism. I mean, these are people who their mainstream conservative credentials are impeccable. So you have people like that there. You have people like Dan McCarthy, who I mentioned earlier, who was the former editor of the American Conservative, who I think for a long time has been more associated with some of these ideas. But you realize you bring together the editor of First Things. Chris DeMuth, who's the former president of AEI, he was at this conference. You know, these are respectable mainstream people. So I think really this conference was about bridging the gap between the emerging nationalist ideas on the right and what you might call the mainstream movement conservatism.
Yeah.
And if you can get these ideas injected more and more into mainstream conservative thought, that's a huge victory for the Trumpists. It's part of the ongoing Trumpification of the right.
And there's kind of an irony at work here, because one of the themes that a lot of the speakers touched upon is like neoconservatism is dead. Neoliberalism is dead. The Reaganite consensus is over. The idea that being conservative means this sort of unquestioning fealty to open markets is no longer true. Like, we need to take care of people who live in this nation. The irony, of course, is that really, I mean, it signals an intellectual break in some ways, but the same people are in the room, you know?
Right, like, yeah.
They're not really casting out anybody. You know, Bill Kristol wasn't there. Like, Jonah Goldberg wasn't there. But really, the distinction with those people is not really a deep philosophical distinction. It's that those people are anti-Trump.
Exactly. If you were to look at the people in this room and say, who wasn't there? The only type of conservative who wasn't there, as Sam pointed out, is the most forceful and committed anti-Trumpists.
Yeah. It is a significant thing that should not be rolled over, that these are conservatives allied with the Republican Party, and one of the things that they're saying is that inequality is a huge problem, that the government has a role to play in providing basic material comfort for families, for the good ordinary folk of this country. And look, there was compassionate conservatism in the past, the Reformicon stuff, but there is a degree to which, like we talked about last week, they are really signaling a break from the consensus opinion of sort of the fusionism of conservatism past, which prized market fundamentalism as one of the first principles, libertarian economics.
J.D. Vance was there, author of Hillbilly Elegy, and his talk was basically all directed at libertarians.
Yeah.
And then neocons were another enemy, in the sense of neocons as the kind of iteration of neoconservatism that is associated with the Iraq War and kind of American empire, the imperial project. Those were the two big enemies, libertarians and neocons.
And the left.
And the left. Yeah, of course, the left. And so really what remained then of the traditional conservative fusionism was the social conservatism.
Yeah.
And in a way, they're saying the economics and the foreign policy need to follow from the social conservatism, that in some ways, these ideas percolating on the right, a lot of them are being driven by social conservatives who think that the previous coalition, they got the raw deal in it.
And like Matt is saying, I just wanted to read just for a second from this, a good piece that was about the conference and about Missouri Senator Josh Hawley in particular by Alexander Zaychik. I'm not sure if I'm saying that name right, in the New Republic, where he said, for their decades of junior partnership in a movement based on false ideas about human nature, the post-liberals hold up a dismal tally. A hollowed-out culture, trans story hour at the local library, a few good judges, but not enough, a postcard of Grover Norquist in a Speedo, and dust goggles postmarked from the pagan bacchanal of Burning Man. So, you know, it's a good sentence. But, you know, basically what they're saying is, like, what good, as we talked about last week, what good has the Fusionist Alliance done social conservatives if what we're left with is these Silicon Valley elites who go to Burning Man every year, Grover Norquist complaining about taxes but not really providing anything for the white middle-class base of the conservative party, of the Republican Party, and, of course, their absolute terror in the face of gender and sexual nonconformity.
Yeah. I think it's worth pointing out, too, that I think in this case, when we mention social conservatism, it's a little more expansive than just meaning religious conservatives.
Yeah.
Because there was a lot at this conference. Again, we'll talk about all this in more detail, but there was a lot at the conference about birth rates and kind of natalism kind of stuff. And, you know, opioid deaths.
Yeah.
And you don't have to be religious. I think often religious people are the most concerned with things like birth rates. But you can be a secular conservative and just think, listen, healthy countries have babies.
Yeah.
Societies that are struggling, they don't. And that's a marker of kind of social health.
Yeah.
So I think it's when we say social conservative, I think it is worth just pointing out that it doesn't mean they're all like the religious right exactly.
No, not exactly.
Well, we should talk about some of the actual talks and get into some of the specifics. That was enough of an overview. And again, this was 2.5 days of talks and panels, keynotes, and then kind of breakout sessions on more particular topics like immigration. And we can't talk about all of them, obviously, but we wanted to focus on a few key talks. And we're going to start with Yoram Hazony's talk, because he was kind of admittedly so, I think, the intellectual guru behind all this, or one of them.
Yeah, he sort of convened the conference in a certain way. I don't know who else was involved in choosing, inviting speakers to come or whatever, but clearly, you know, he did the opening and closing remarks of the conference. And it seemed to me that he chose the phrase national conservatism, which is not really, that wasn't really a phrase in the public conversation. People weren't talking about something called national conservatism.
Right.
Giving a name to a set of ideas and trying to make them cohere.
Yeah. And I think his talk was one of the more useful overviews of the ideas that were shared at this conference. Now, as we said earlier, Hazony is the author of a book called The Virtues of Nationalism. He's the president of the Herzl Institute in Jerusalem, and previously had been he had run a center called the Shalem Center in Jerusalem, which was like a right-wing Israeli think tank that was very close with the Netanyahu people.
Yeah, he was an advisor to Netanyahu at some point, though I've read in a couple different places that they personally now really dislike each other. But certainly he's associated with the really scary Israeli right, which has sort of taken over the country.
Yeah, yeah. And I think he was an undergraduate at Princeton and then did his PhD at Rutgers, which is where Dineen did his PhD. So they go back a ways.
Yeah.
So Hazony began by citing Irving Kristol.
Yeah.
And he said the three pillars of conservatism are religion, nationalism, and economic growth. That was a quote from Kristol that Hazony pointed to. And Hazony's
Kristol's father.
Yeah. Yes. father of Bill.
Yeah.
And then Hazony begins also by saying something has gone terribly wrong with conservatism. And he really associates this with the fall of the Berlin Wall. Like, after the Cold War, conservatism lost its bearings. He points to, in his book, he mentions Margaret Thatcher. He says, like, really all this began, you can date some of this stuff to when Thatcher was ousted in 1990.
Because
she opposed integration to the EU.
Yeah.
Yes. And then he name checks George H.W. Bush and the New World Order, which he says a chill raced down his spine. Utopian thinking has swept the political right, and it's ruined everything it's touched.
Yeah, Hazony's argument about the iteration of conservatism that reigned in the 90s was that it was hubristic. Communism is done, and the project can be establishing a liberal world order based on peace and prosperity, and that the United States is the country to play this role of establishing this sort of utopian liberal capitalist global world order.
Right. And it was in this speech that Hazzoni said that we declare independence from neoconservatism and from neoliberalism. He pointed to enemies on the left, which is infected in his mind with individualism and economic thinking, the rational choosing individual, and to the right, the alt-right, white identitarianism, racial thinking.
Yeah.
What's interesting is he said neither of those are actually political, are genuinely political. On the one hand, on the left, politics is subsumed to economics, and on the right, it's subsumed to race. And then he moves into the heart of the speech by saying there are three big ideas he wanted to talk about. The first is national independence, the second is national cohesion, and the third are national traditions.
Yeah.
And the bulk of his speech is about teasing out those three ideas that he mentioned at the start.
I wanted to read just a little bit from his Declaration of Independence moment, and sort of just, I mean, he eviscerated neoconservatism. He said, in all of their efforts to establish this American empire around the globe, what they were left with is Middle East ablaze, China a serious threat having been propped up by the United States.
A threat we created.
Yeah, that's what he's saying. Country flooded with porn and with drugs, rusted out industrial factories, John Lennon clones, he said, in Silicon Valley, having this huge influence over the shape of our public discourse and society, borders dissolved, no balanced budgets or paying debts, universities only hiring Marxists, and Christianity is free-falling. This is the legacy of American conservatism as far as Yoram Hazzoni is concerned. He wasn't pulling punches. Like Matt said, he said we declare independence from neoconservatism and from neoliberalism and what they call, quote, classical liberalism, which is a jibe at these never Trumpers who have adopted that term, David French and Jonah Goldberg.
So the first of these ideas, national independence, Sam's getting at that some. It means America not being entangled in this kind of global economic order to the degree it is. It should put the national interest first, rather than, as he mentioned, like propping up China or ceding too much ground to China. So that's okay, fair
or
enough.
Or in the same sense, like trying to establish democracy around the world, make the world safe for democracy as the sort of
right.
the principles of the war on terror.
Right.
Terror would have.
So national independence kind of means like not an empire. Too.
Yeah.
But then things got really interesting when he started talking about national cohesion, because he says you can't have cohesion over nothing. Cohesion has to be based on something shared. A nation has to have things that hold it together. And for him, this really means kind of biblical faith.
Yeah.
And that phrase biblical faith is how you kind of capture both Christianity and Judaism. And he says even a generation or two ago, this biblical faith was still thick.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point he says, I'm talking about God and scripture, nation and family, man and woman, the sacred and the honorable. He says every single one of these things that held the nation together has come under attack.
Right.
And he blames conservatives for some of this, because he said in the 60s, conservatives went along with the idea that you could privatize religion and that you could be reasonable without God and scripture, which is itself a very pregnant phrase. And he says, this is a quote, it turns out God and scripture was holding in place the entire set of structures, not reason. And then this was the moment in his talk that I thought was just kind of amazing, a spectacular line. He says, you throw out Christianity, you throw out the Torah, you throw out God, and within two generations, people can't tell the difference between a man and a woman. They can't tell the difference between a foreigner and a citizen. They can't tell the difference between this side of the border and the other side of the border. They can't tell the difference between paying back your debts and simply borrowing forever.
Mm-hmm.
That's a direct quote.
Yeah.
And that was the heart of his case. And it was interesting because it ties all the stuff together.
Right.
It connects borders to trans people.
Right.
It connects the nationalist project to social conservatism. And even by the mention of debts and borrowing, he didn't elaborate on that, But
it's still a fig leaf to the kind of like
fiscal rectitude element of conservatism. Yes. And then he says the only way to save this country, to bring it back to cohesion, this is another quote, to bring it back to independence and health, the only way to do it is going to restore these traditions. And then he kind of like admits this will be tricky because atheists exist.
Right.
It was kind of an aside. And then he kind of closed by saying, you know, will America be ruled by Brussels? And like people laughed in the crowd, kind of yeah. like as a joke. And they said, that's not funny. It's what they teach in universities. And then he name checks Anglo-American traditions in this kind of vague way. But it was a very religious speech. There was an emphasis on the English language.
It was a
Anglo-American
sermon.
Traditions. It was a sermon. It was just watching it, I don't want to say I was shocked because I knew a little bit about Hazzoni. But it was just striking how stridently religious it was.
Yeah.
Sam, what did you make of the speech?
I felt the same way. His delivery was a little bit eerie. A lot of these felt like academic lectures, and some of them felt like political speeches. Tucker uh-huh. Carlson did Tucker Carlson.
Yeah.
But this was something different. There was like a twinkle in his eyes.
He's a true believer. I mean, I grew up a religious fundamentalist.
Right.
So I was telling Sam before we started recording, I mean, there was, Sam points to that twinkle in his eye or that kind of look he gave. I do admit I had a little bit of PTSD from my religious upbringing because it was the vehemence of it and the stridency and the certainty of being right.
Yeah.
That he had the answers.
Yeah.
And that our country had forsaken the real answers.
Yeah.
When we got rid of God, when we got rid of Christianity, when we got rid of the Bible, when we got rid of the Torah.
Yeah.
And the moral chaos infecting the country is a direct result of that. And that was, you know, you take out some of the references to the Jewish tradition, and this could have been something my pastor said mm-hmm. growing up.
Yeah. But the Jewish tradition actually is very important to Hazzoni.
Really,
I mean,
is.
Obviously, he's a right-wing Israeli who advised Bibi Netanyahu. But the reason that it's so important is because he actually roots the idea of nations in the Old Testament. And the sort of the nation of Israel, as it's described in the Hebrew Bible, is where this all comes from. And so there's a natural connection for him between how important religion is for social cohesion and the idea of the nation, because it's all stemming for him from the events of the Hebrew Bible and also the stories in the scripture.
Right. Israel, the kingdom of Israel, was the first nation state for him.
Yeah.
Or the first national state. Maybe the word nation state wouldn't be quite, you know, what he uses. But anytime the Bible talks about the nations, Hazzoni wasn't the only one who pointed this out. Rusty Reno did the same, I believe. But anytime the Bible references nations, they take that to be giving the modern nation state something of an imprimatur, which I thought was extremely odd.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you read the Hebrew Bible and it's the Moabites and the Hittites. And these are kind of like, I mean, I'm not a scholar, a biblical scholar, but they just aren't. Like
it's,
modern Germany,
it's just
a
translation
right?
of a particular word. It doesn't. Yeah. It's just what the nation came to mean in the modern era. Just really doesn't have anything to do with what that word means in the translation, in English translation of the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah,
it's a sleight of hand.
Yeah, but it is interesting because it does then it tries to root all this in scripture, in religious tradition, and give it that which is important for a lot of the people they're trying to win over.
And obviously, I mean, this is you listener, you smart, keen listener, have probably already picked up on this. But Hazzoni, as a true Zionist, deep believer in the project of the nation state of Israel, there's an extent to which it's not just about the Israel of the Bible; it's about the Israel of the present. There's a way in which the nationalism he's describing and prescribing for America has this consonance with Israeli nationalism for him. And that makes sense in a way because Israel is such a recently founded nation who had to go through this process of creating a common culture, creating a common language, I mean, you know, rediscovering a common language and, you know, and building a nation. So Hazzoni didn't talk about like Middle East, I mean, he didn't talk about Israeli politics in this speech, but you have to know Israel as it exists today is sort of a shadow over everything that he says. I wanted to pick up on one thing, which was the Matt mentioned this, but Hazzoni said that we have you know opponents to our right and opponents to our left, and the people to his left, he's saying, are these individualist liberals, And to his right, he says, are the white nationalists. So he actually links these two phenomena by saying that they're both based on, you know, a fiction, but that the white nationalists understand that the liberal justification for society is wrong, and they try to build a new reality on the basis of population genetics and evolutionary biology. But we're going to talk more about how ideas about race play into this whole conference. You know, the fact that they aren't talking about skin color doesn't mean that racial hierarchy isn't kind of in the air in every single one of these speeches.
So we'll return to the idea of race and its connections to nationalism at the end of this episode, because we do want to zoom out and kind of give a lot of commentary. We're trying to run through some of what was just said.
And as usual, we're trying to give the devil his due.
We're trying to give the devil his due.
I think we should talk about Holly first.
All right, go for it.
Holly is sort of, like we said, very clean and smooth political vessel for this set of ideas. Very careful, very studied. He's 39 years old, right? He's young.
He's a good speaker.
He's a good speaker.
He's handsome.
He has a sense of oratory.
He has strong evangelical dad energy.
Yeah. I'm less familiar with that, but I believe you.
Like handsome white guy who's an evangelical with a picture-perfect family and, you know.
And like all of these guys, he's got a certain kind of sort of historical literacy, or at least he's got like anecdotes from classical history that he'll use to animate you know, contemporary ideas and debates.
Yeah. He was all about these kind of ancient references. But it's worth, he also mentioned Teddy Roosevelt, who he wrote a book about.
Right.
His I think it was his thesis at Stanford. Was published later on.
Yale University Press, I think.
Yeah, by University Press as a book about Teddy Roosevelt. And it's worth mentioning, too, that Holly,
he's leading the charge of cracking down on Silicon Valley and breaking up Facebook.
Right, which is interesting because when he was at Stanford, he was involved with the Stanford Review, which is the right-wing newspaper / rag founded by Peter Thiel.
Yeah, and Peter Thiel is at this conference. He's made his money from Facebook and probably funding to a significant degree. Well, definitely funding to a significant degree Hawley's political career. That's in the record. But also probably funding this conference. Hawley's personal biographical trajectory is one of just doing every single thing that you're supposed to do to become a successful conservative politician or mover and shaker, mm-hmm. right? Like he...
And that includes cozying up to the Koch brothers, taking a lot of their money.
Tons of money from Koch.
Like, if you had met Josh Hawley in, say, 2010, which is when he published that essay in National Affairs called on Epicurean Liberalism, which we won't get into, but that's something a totally mainstream conservative would have done in 2010. He's publishing in National Affairs. He's friendly with, like, the Koch organizations.
And importantly, right, he clerks for conservative judges and then ultimately John Roberts.
Right.
He gets his law degree. He goes and works for probably a white shoe firm. And
then in 2016 runs for Attorney General of Missouri, and then in 2018 runs for the Senate.
And also we should say his political star rises a lot because he litigates some part of the Hobby Lobby case.
Oh, right.
Before he runs for AG, that's kind of the story that he tells to become mm-hmm. the sort of anointed Republican candidate for AG in Missouri. So look, he's doing it all. Like he is a perfect kind of specimen of like conservative ideas, the look,
credentials, history,
the race.
Yeah. And then it is interesting, in 2018, he did kind of cozy up to Trump. Trump campaigned for him. He sounded some Trumpian notes.
Right. And you know, we have to,
so we saw which way the wind was blowing.
There. That's one argument. It doesn't really matter. I mean, this kind of like tea leaf reading about what people's sincere beliefs are and whether they're a weather vane at certain times. Like, usually that's just all speculation and not that important. But he wrote this book about Teddy Roosevelt, and one of the things that he's praising about him is sort of his role as like a trust buster and as sort of like holding the corporate world's feet to the fire. So there was always a strain of this kind of populist conservatism yeah. in his thinking. And, you know, in some ways, his political star met a moment where there was a much larger audience for those that set of ideas, mm-hmm. too.
And yeah, I'm interested in Holly not so much for sussing out what he deep down really believes, but as a weather vane for what's going on in conservatism.
Right.
Like, again...
He's the only politician at this conference.
Yeah, but... Again, he would have seemed like a basic... He was in the mainstream of conservatism prior to 2018. And so he's an interesting figure in part just because he's signing on to this national agenda as a U.S. senator, and but also as someone who had been kind of come up through conservative institutions.
Totally through the pipeline, yeah, as we have called it.
Through the pipeline. So his talk, I mean, probably the most controversial part of it was his... I mean, a lot of it's framed around... a cosmopolitan consensus that he is dissenting from and yeah. that he thinks this nationalist conservatism is an alternative to. But he got into some trouble when he teased out what he meant by the cosmopolitan consensus. He referenced four academics who said various things about patriotism or, you know, argued for world citizenship.
Our obligations to people outside of our nations.
Yes.
And stuff like that.
And well, Sam, what happened?
Right. Well, three of the four people that he mentioned, and he you know, he read quotes from their books as sort of like the this is the terrifying thing they're teaching people in the universities. Three of the four of them were Jewish, and so some writers and critics noted that when you're talking about a cosmopolitan elite, you know, a rootless cosmopolitan elite. He didn't say rootless. I don't think that would be even more of a watchword. The hackles of anti-Semitism get up. And so people accused him of anti-Semitism. In the same vein that we mentioned before, like, it's not that interesting to me to know what is in Josh Hawley's heart. Does he have animus towards the Jewish people? Maybe, but not necessarily. But what I think that does need to be imagined, does need to be acknowledged, and that in some ways obviates the question of whether he's literally an anti-Semite, is that there's a tradition of left secular Judaism which prizes cosmopolitanism, internationalism. And there's a reason for that, which is that in states that start becoming nationalistic, there's pogroms, you know? Like, yeah. Jews get killed when nationalism arises.
Right.
And so there is a Jewish tradition, intellectual tradition, of prizing this idea of cosmopolitan states. Nationalism has historically also been constituted in relation to anti-Semitism. So you can't really escape it, because, you know, the Jew is the figure of non-assimilation, rootless person, not patriotic, not loyal to the state that they're living in. That's the quote-unquote Jewish problem. I guess what I'm saying is that when Josh Hawley attacks a cosmopolitan elite, he's not necessarily talking about Jews. It's sort of a distraction. The important thing is, like, what are the implications of nationalism? What is the historiography of nationalism? Where does this impulse come from, and what has it done in the past? And, you know, I think if you're a Jew, you should be worried about nationalism.
Not because Josh Hawley's an anti-Semite, but because of where these ideas tend to go.
Yeah.
Whether or not the people behind them themselves, in every case, are personally anti-Semitic.
And one of the reasons that our sort of alarm bells are going off about this anti-Semitism, like, people like me, Jewish leftists, we hear this stuff and it immediately goes off, is because there's also a way in which one of the things that this national conservatism represents is a version of American conservatism that has a lot more similarities with European conservatism, where anti-Semitism plays a really fundamental role. Like, anti-Semitism hasn't played the same role in American conservatism,
yeah, that's
true, as it does in Europe.
Uh-huh.
And so alarm bells also go off for that reason. I don't know if this really settles anything about this controversy about his anti-Semitism. It's just meant to put it in a sort of intellectual historiographic context. The question of what's in his heart is not as important as how this fits, right, into a set of ideas.
Which is similar to the way, you know, at least some on the left talk about race, which is that the emphasis is on structures and racist structures and policies, rather than figuring out what deep down is in any particular individual's heart.
Right.
And I think the structure of nationalist arguments is what can sometimes be problematic. Well, we should just talk about a few things in the speech other than what Hawley said about cosmopolitanism, because I think Hawley's speech gets at a lot of the problems with the with nationalist conservatism, in the sense that there was he invoked flat wages, lost jobs, declining investment, declining opportunity, small towns, as he put it, small towns like the one where I grew up in Middle Missouri struggle and disappear, and a way of life is lost. So he invokes the struggles of the American worker, but there was not it was not clear what the answer is, at least in his speech. He name checks the epidemic of suicide and drug addiction. And then he says, is it any surprise, this is a quote, that in the last half century, as our leaders have pursued a program the American middle class does not espouse, does not support, and does not benefit from, that public confidence in American government has collapsed, end quote. He talks about people feeling disempowered and disrespected, and the cosmopolitan agenda drives both left and right. The right celebrates hyper-globalization and promises the market will fix everything, whereas the left champions multiculturalism and degrades our common identity. And it's a strange speech because he says all that, and then he talks about 2,000 years ago. The self-governing city-states met the radical claims of a Jewish rabbi who taught that God calls every person. The power of God can work through each. And then he talks about the individual. So I viewed a lot of the speech as both touching on the real problems we're facing, but then also kind of nodding to the more traditional conservative rhetoric about the individual. And but then it all cashes out, this is interesting to me, in republicanism. A lot of the speeches name-checked the republic, the idea of republicanism, which is not the same as democracy, mm-hmm. right? So this connects back to some of what we talked about last episode with the kind of anti-democratic impulse on the right. And I only mentioned the republicanism stuff because that's a kind of political theory rabbit hole we don't have to go down. But it's an interesting rhetorical move to make because it kind of invokes elites having more of a sense of responsibility for the common good rather than a genuine concern for democratic political life and democratic participation.
Right.
So, and I also think republicanism is a way of de-emphasizing class struggle.
Yeah.
Because it's really a kind of national unity kind of philosophy where the disparate parts work together for the common good,
yeah.
rather than even within a single country, workers viewing bosses as their enemies.
As an opponent, yeah.
Yes. So, and I've noticed this more and more on the right, that if you're looking for one way a kind of left populism might distinguish itself from a right populism, I do think the right, at the end of the day, they're not into real class analysis or class struggle. They're a kind of one nation conservatism,
yeah.
to use the British phrase, and that you should help workers, but not necessarily give them power.
Yeah.
And it's notable that Holly's a deeply anti-union figure.
Right. Let's go into that a little bit. I mean, his political positions. Okay. Yes. He wants to empower federal agencies like the FTC to break up big corporations like Facebook. You know, the reasons for that, there's a social conservative element of that too. But the point is he has a critique of corporations, corporatism, and the role of big business in American life, and that corporations don't, this is what Tucker Carlson's speech is called, corporations don't care about your family, or big business doesn't care about your family. There's that element in his stuff. But look, when it comes down to actually the kinds of things that help working class people get ahead in American society, down the line, he's pretty bad. Like, he's pro-right to work. In his campaign against Claire McCaskill, he criticized the minimum wage,
which was on the ballot, I believe.
He supported eliminating the inheritance tax, what they call the death tax. Like, that one, if you think there's an elite that recreates itself generation after generation, uh-huh. and which is out of touch with the struggles of mainstream society, you got to support a big inheritance tax. That's how it works. Mm-hmm. They give their money to the next generation, and the broader public doesn't benefit from this accumulated wealth that mm-hmm. these people didn't do anything to earn.
Yeah.
So he's against the inheritance tax. He called the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau unconstitutional, the big populist anti-bank institution, right? So, like, why he has all these positions, you know, he took like $10 million from the Koch brothers. Maybe he's just got to pay. There's some things, lines he's not allowed to cross. And maybe, you know, a sincere Josh Hawley is more of a true economic populist. But the fact is, it's bullshit.
Yeah. And this is what we got at last episode. The problem with corporations for these people is that they're woke. One of the speeches at the conference specifically said, well, you know, Google, they can make ideas disappear. Meaning...
Tucker Carlson said that.
Yeah. Oh, Tucker Carlson said that. But the sentiment is the same, which is that these big corporations, the problem is that they put their thumb on the scale on behalf of progressive ideas. They're woke.
They're
for LGBT rights.
Shit.
And that's the problem. And when he is talking about going after Google or Facebook or whatever, it often is for those reasons.
You got to keep that in mind. In his first Senate speech, Hawley described an epidemic of loneliness and despair. A society increasingly defined not by the genuine and personal love of family and church, but by the cold and judgmental world of social media.
And so you
can't separate the sort of populist economics from the social conservatism, the ideas about the family, about God. And like we talked about last week about the First Things people, the Amaris and Rusty Rinos, he also like zooms in on the idea that like the Lockean principle of liberty, it consecrates, and this is a quote, the right to choose your own meaning, define your own values, emancipate yourself from God by creating your own self. And that's the like the crux of it for these people, is that of their critique of liberalism. Not that it justifies capitalism, not that it creates inequality, but that it creates an atomizing version of liberty, the right to self-create. It creates relativism, right? Which is to say, it creates a society where the word of God is not law.
Mm-hmm. And when he, again, this is a speech that's his speech at the conference, is very hazy on details. You know, he does name check economic concentration, but then he talks about trade policies that put American workers first and an immigration system that rewards, he puts it, he wants one that rewards and nourishes American labor rather than devaluing it. So it is interesting that probably the most specific he got, it was about the stuff that Trump's into, trade yeah. policy and immigration, more than the kinds of things that a Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren are talking about.
Yeah.
Right? That would actually truly check some of these problems in American life or begin to reverse them.
So, yeah. Yeah. One thing you just always have to keep in mind is when these people, when it sounds like they're criticizing capitalism, when they're criticizing inequality or the effects of capitalism, like all that stuff about deindustrialization, even the epidemic of loneliness and despair, right? You have to understand that what they're worried about, it's not really social justice, right? It's that the effect of those problems on society is to undermine a concept of communal bonds, of hierarchy, of religiosity.
The family,
right? You know, these people are worried about, like, the two-income trap, the marriage wage, like, all of the conservative redistributive politics, they tend to be in service of the culture war, right? The culture mm-hmm. war comes first. The dissolution of the patriarchal family, the decline in birth rates, the redistributive politics is always for the purpose of preserving some kind of sense of a traditional society.
The American middle, as he calls it.
Yeah.
He keeps referencing the American middle.
Yeah. And that's another one, like ordinary voters, like blah, blah, blah.
The common man.
The common people that is coded, racially coded, usually. But I wanted to say that we can talk about this more at the end, but that this rooting of material demands, redistributive politics, in a sense, in moral politics and in familial communal politics, is actually really powerful and can be important. I mean, it serves the ends of like reifying their idea of like the religious order. But also, it's true that the left sometimes falls into the trap of making talking about material benefits as if they will immediately solve all the problems, mm-hmm. right? And we don't always articulate very well what these material benefits enable in terms of living a good life. I mean, lots of elements of the left actually do that well. These people pretend like they don't exist.
Right.
But when we do talk about redistribution, giving a floor to people in society, we are talking about giving people more leisure time, giving people time to be with their families if they choose to. To live a good life is to live in community. Mm-hmm. And it's really endlessly frustrating to me that the right commandeers the language of community, of solidarity, of mutual aid and obligation from the left.
So that's kind of a rundown of a number of the major talks. There's some we didn't get into. J.D. Vance gave a talk that was kind of a broadside against libertarianism. Peter Thiel gave a talk in which he, among other things, called for the CIA and FBI to investigate, like Google executives, to find out how much they've been infiltrated by China. So there's elements of this talk we did not, of this conference we didn't get into. I'm told this isn't a video that's available yet, but Julius Krein, the editor of American Affairs, I think gave maybe a more detailed talk about like national industrial policy.
Yeah.
So there might be some details at this conference that we didn't get into, in part because the materials just aren't available. But one of the talks that did happen at a panel on immigration, that also was one of the major features in the press of this conference, was a talk by Amy Wax. And Sam, I know you wanted to discuss that in some detail. Before I turn it over to you, Amy Wax and I believe Scott McConnell, both in their talks on this panel, praised the Rivers of Blood speech by
Enoch Powell.
Enoch Powell. And that was...
who is a British member of Parliament who famous gave this epic speech. He was in the late 60s?
60s or 70s, yeah.
Where he denounced immigration, mass immigration, and
in the most kind of incendiary terms you can imagine,
rivers
of blood.
Just as a reminder, Amy Wax is the law professor at Penn Law who got in hot water... I don't know how long ago it was, a few months or maybe a year, time is weird, where she said that she had never seen a black student in the top 10% of the class or something like that.
Uh-huh.
This person still has her job, by the way. And this time she spoke about immigration policy, and she advocated for an immigration policy based on sort of cultural affinity. And what she said was that in effect, this means, and this is a quote, taking the position that our country will be better off with more whites and fewer non-whites. Now, the context in which she says that is, look, this isn't a racial policy. I'm saying that we want people who share the Judeo-Christian tradition, who share our values, who share our sense of our ideas about self-governance. It just so happens that the people who share those values are white and come from white countries. But I'm not saying... the racist thing. And mm-hmm. what she's saying is it's a big impediment to achieving our goal of immigration policy based on cultural affinity that it will appear to be racist.
Right.
And Hazzoni defended her on Twitter on precisely those grounds.
Oh, yeah. It was long thread.
He says, she's not saying that we want white people. She's saying that we want people who are culturally like us. And in fact, it's an obstacle to achieving that people will call it racist. The distinction is not important. It's a distinction without difference. Like the distinction between I want more white people and less non-white people, and the best people happen to come from white countries and happen to be white. That's not a distinction. That's not an important distinction.
Yeah.
And so I think what's interesting about Amy Wax is, in fact, she provides for us the connective tissue between the nationalist cultural politics and the racial politics, because what she says is that you can go back and listen to every single one of these speeches, and every time somebody says Judeo-Christian values, traditional values,
Anglo-American values,
our traditions, you can remember what Amy Wax said. What that means is white people. Mm-hmm. In effect, what that means is white people. And so this question of whether or not the principles of this conference are at their root, whether the people who are there have racism in their heart, is totally beside the point. And Amy Wax shows us why. When people talk about Judeo-Christian values, the reason that sets off alarm bells is because that language is connected to a politics of white racial superiority. It's connected to it, right?
Right.
It's not synonymous, but...
it's possible to draw a conceptual difference between culture and race, but in practice, they mean that they're pointing to the same people.
Yeah.
And this was interesting because we briefly mentioned this last episode, but there was that profile that The Atlantic published about First Things and edited by Rusty Reno, a participant in this conference. And Emma Green, the author, when she was sitting down talking with him, somehow, you know, not somehow, but obviously because of Trump, because of some of the things published in First Things, the question of immigration came up. And she said something like, well, for all the hand-wringing over people flooding in across our southern border, would you have the same problem with, or would it be a similar issue if it was coming from our northern border, from Canada? And Reno says no. Now, what is the difference between Canadians and Mexicans? Because if you're a good Catholic, like at some level, you should talk about Judeo-Christian. All yeah. these Catholics coming from Mexico or Guatemala,
it's
or
the growth in the Catholic Church, right?
Right. Yeah. So it's certainly not a religious heritage that you're talking about when you're discussing immigration. The difference between a Canadian yeah. and a Mexican. So what is the difference? There's really only one that I can think of. And in some sense, if you're concerned with traditional religious values, why would you want some like Justin Trudeau-esque, you know?
Canadians are horrible. I totally agree.
You know, socialists from the Great North coming in whenever, and it's a staple of right-wing rhetoric to point to various things happening in Canada. Yeah. It's like, it's going to come here too.
Yeah.
You know, some commission in Canada cost someone their job because they said something that's not politically correct. And the right always seizes on these examples. So that's just a practical kind of comment from Reno that I think bears out your point.
Another interesting way to get into what this conference was really about, what the upshot of this conference is, what it means for politics, is to look at the criticisms of this conference from the right. So there's incredible, I think, incredible. I mean that not in moral nor normative terms, but this piece in The Federalist, mostly what it's saying, it was insufficiently nationalist and insufficiently pro-Trump. Like, they were frustrated, they were annoyed that people avoided saying Trump, right?
Right.
And that actually...
Which is true.
They avoided saying Trump because he's seen... The idea that The Federalist is getting at is that they avoided saying Trump because he's seen it as this crass and his racial politics are dangerous and blah, 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 blah. But what the Federalist people are saying is, no. He is what he's doing is what we need. And he's created these conditions for this thing to be possible. So I just want to read a bit from it, from this Federalist critique. So this is a critique of the National Conservatism Conference from the right. It says, overall, the entire event fails to cohere, precisely because abstract nationalism and abstract traditionalism fail in the same way liberalism fails. They purport neutrality and ecumenism while surreptitiously importing thick conceptions of the good. Who precisely constitutes our nation? Who are Americans? What is America? Hazzoni never quite says. In this sense, national conservatism is ambiguous. Is it national, meaning Anglo-American, or is it national, meaning nationwide, federal? What these people are saying is that you're being too coy. You got to come out and say it. If you're gonna be nationalist, you got to go all the way. And what that means is you can't shy away from the racial politics. And the Federalist is also lodging a critique on the idea that this is a clean break with conservatism of the past.
Especially neoconservatism.
Yeah, because they also say, and this is another quote from this article, they say, any donor should ask Hazzoni, with whom do you stand? With Bolton or with Tucker? With other nations or with America? Cast one of them off or I'll know you're lying to me. The right is a big tent, but the Bill Kristols and David Broggs have left. Presenting them alongside Tucker Carlson is not, quote, promoting debate. It is rehabilitating losers.
Right, yeah.
Matt can probably speak to this better than I can, but what this writer in The Federalist is saying is that really what you're doing is making nationalism palatable to the traditional conservative movement.
Right, which I think is correct. I think I mentioned this kind of at the start of the episode, but I think that actually is what happened. It's the subtitle for this article at The Federalist. I can't believe we're
crazy name, in a who's Federalist it, article. Who's the author?
His name's Andrew Kloster.
Shout out.
Kloster. But the title is Not the National Conservatism We've Been Looking For, and the subtitle is Promoting the Same Failed Policies and Rehabilitating the Same Failed Experts, in square quotes, simply because they've rebranded as national conservatives will not advance the American cause. And I actually think that's kind of perceptive and right.
Yeah.
That this was an exercise in rebranding. And as Sam mentioned, they have some particular criticisms. Like this author, he focuses a lot on neoconservatism. But he says, you know, when you have a panel on foreign policy moderated by an AEI guy, an American Enterprise Institute fellow, how different is this from...
How seriously are you taking this anti-imperial stance?
Right. And he says... This is a quote from the piece. Closter says, "It is not as if honest America First foreign policy experts were unavailable. Scott McConnell served on an immigration panel, for example, but they were cabined to speaking on other issues. This was, I think, no accident. In the immigration panel, did it include a single representative of the Center for Immigration Studies, which is the right-wing restrictionist think tank, if you can call it that.
And John Bolton spoke, right? John Bolton, is he national security advisor now?
Yes. And he points out, he says, Bolton's speech was so replete with, I think, and my opinion is, that one came away with the impression that he forgets he has a boss. Worse, Bolton is openly the least America First of the senior administration officials serving Trump's signature three areas, trade, immigration, and foreign policy. And then he says, was Ambassador Robert Lighthizer invited? Stephen Miller? Peter Navarro?
Yeah.
No, none of these individuals were invited. And so this is actually, again, my commitments are very different than this author's. Yeah. But I think he was basically correct in understanding that the conference was chiefly an effort in rebranding. And I think you can get at this, I mentioned this earlier, but when you look at who was there, again, a lot of these people, you would have seen them in the same room for a different conservative conference 5-10 years ago.
Yeah.
And this was kind of bridging the gap between the new nationalism, if you want to call it that, and the mainstream right, what you would call movement conservatism. And some people weren't there, but a lot of people were there, and it was really only the most deeply anti-Trump conservatives who weren't there. And we mentioned that earlier. So that's my big picture takeaway is both, I think this is both a weakness and a strength of it. It's a weakness because as this author points out in The Federalist, I mean, it really wasn't a clean break. And so you do have to wonder how effective will this be. But the strength of it is that it does smuggle these ideas into the conservative mainstream. And as I said earlier, given the both sidesism of the press, this means that to the extent you can kind of win over mainstream conservatives, whatever mistakes they've made in the past, according to this author, The Federalist, that is still advancing the ball forward for whatever you want to call the intellectuals for Trump. And so I know The Federalist author lamented that there weren't true Trumpian figures there. But in a way, that was part of the point. Yeah. Like he's kind of calling their bluff, but in a way, I'm not sure which way it will actually cut. Because if your idea is to advance, if your program is to advance these ideas, keeping Stephen Miller out of the room is brilliant PR.
Yeah,
not even brilliant. It's just what any sensible person would do.
Mainstreaming and these ideas and making them palatable also gives them money. It gets them access to the big money, right? So like, we don't know exactly who funded this conference yet, but there was a certain number of traditional conservative bigwigs in the room. You know, Josh Hawley has dipped into both sides of this. He's got the Koch money, but he's also speaking at this conference. And the point is, if you make it palatable, so that nationalism is not synonymous with white nationalism, you can get some more of the you know, maybe slightly squeamish right-wing donors to participate in advocating this cause and allowing and sort of creating a pipeline for these ideas in the way that there was a pipeline for fusionist.
And I think the word pipeline is interesting too, because, or important to mention, because, you know, another way of thinking about it is we've mentioned how coy all this is and some of the slipperiness of the ideas they espouse. But when you have magazine editors announcing that they're on board with this, that's also a way that's planting a flag, and some of the intellectual work that might need to be done for Trumpism or this conservative nationalism, national conservatism. This is how it begins to get fleshed out. You get the institutions on board. You get the money on board. You have magazine editors on board. And soon enough, younger people who want to write for these magazines or who have policy ideas, they start, you know, writing for these magazines. And pretty soon what you have is, I think, maybe the biggest weakness of Trumpism so far is there was no intellectual infrastructure behind Trump. There was not the way that the Center for American Progress is basically a Democratic administration in waiting, right?
Right.
The people who will staff the federal agencies and be chief of staff and all that. You know, one of the troubles Trump has had is that he
They didn't have
it. It's very hard for him to find people to staff his damn administration. And I think this begins to solve that problem, and it kind of puts the machinery of the mainstream right in service of something like Trumpism, and it might not bear fruit this year, but maybe even in 2020, or more importantly, in 2024, when Josh Hawley's elected president, you're beginning to build the infrastructure and find the foot soldiers to carry this vision forward for future administrations.
There's one other critique that's sort of from the right that I wanted to mention. It's interesting, like some these right-wing critiques of this conference are in some ways more illuminating than the left ones. But in Jacobite magazine, which is this very, very small magazine of like what they call themselves post-political conservatives, there's a very, very well argued critique of the conference, and critique in particular of Hozzoni's argument in his book, which Hozzoni argues that there's a clear distinction between nationalism and empire, and that nationalism is naturally hostile to imperial aspirations. He goes so far in his book to say that the Nazi Party, that Hitler was not a nationalist, he was an imperialist because he wanted to take over the world, and therefore he was a liberal. Because what liberals want to do is, you know, use the power of the military to create a new world order based on prosperity and peace. So these people in Jacobite point out that that's just crazy. I mean, obviously Hitler was a nationalist. When he talked about occupying countries, taking over countries, they were talking about getting more land for the German people. Right. You know, it was all about nationalism. And they were, obviously the Nazis were influenced by 19th century nationalists like Fichte and
Herder.
Yeah, right. And the Jacobite people point out that it's weird that these people are all talking about nationalism, rah-rah nationalism, and they're not talking about the intellectual progenitors of European nationalism, right?
Right.
These guys, like Fichte, who, you know, basically wrote all about how the German nation was bonded by a shared language, right? It's all about the language, and that's our idea of nationalism. And then other 19th century nationalists who were the progenitors of the sort of eugenicist nationalism of blood and soil. And the Jacobite people, they don't say exactly, they're so intellectually evasive, but they say if you want your nationalist politics to be like taken seriously, you need to read up and cite your sources. And if you're taking nationalism seriously, first of all, nationalism is compatible with empire. The nationalist fervor drives imperial projects. And second of all, you need to get down to brass tacks and explain what it is that binds this nation together. Fichte said it was language. Other people said it was blood. The white nationalists say it's race. You know, again, this is a critique from the right saying you're being too coy.
Yeah, and it's true, because I will say the truth in that criticism is that the conference, and we've said this in various ways, but it was so abstract. There are two dimensions to this. One is, again, they use a lot of language like Anglo-American traditions. Well, what does that mean? I mean, we're talking about traditions that span hundreds of years, that include some rather nasty and vile elements, that include some good elements. You know, so any appeal to tradition has to grapple with how you sift the good and the bad parts of it. It's not a unitary thing. But then also, as Sam, as you're getting at, there was no real attention at all to how nation states came to be. Right, these are not timeless entities that have always existed, and when you get down to it, like, you know, well, there's a couple elements to this. Like, well, like, why should the German nation state be treated as this kind of always existing entity when we know it was pieced together from various smaller kingdoms, or with Italy, all these European nations that are now nation states?
Yeah,
you know, they have a much more complicated history, and it's not clear why, say, borders should be drawn this way rather than that way, or at what point in their development you can say, stop.
Yeah.
Okay. Now we've completed the formation of nation state. And when it comes to the United States, even if you put aside the European experience, when you come to the United States, sorry, we're an empire. We're a continent-spanning empire, governed from a city with a bunch of Romanesque buildings in it. you know? Yeah. And even if you look at the history of the United States, so when you talk about the American tradition, do you mean the America of the first 13 colonies?
Yeah.
Do you mean the America before the Louisiana Purchase? You know, some of the states that are in the United States right now, when did Alaska come into the Union? Only in the last, 75 years?
Yeah, and Hawaii later.
And Hawaii later. So the ahistorical nature of what was said
truly
was, when you think about it, from an intellectual standpoint, from a historical point of view, it was both really disingenuous and extremely unserious.
Yeah.
To be honest.
But I think it's symptomatic. It's like the purpose is not intellectual
seriousness
investigation
or
historical rigor.
Yeah.
The purpose is providing intellectual scaffolding for Trumpism, Trump,
it's a lot
he
of backfill.
Represents. It's backfill.
Well, you might say, for the conservative, the way they use the past is it's always a usable past. It's never the past and its complications and messiness and good parts and bad parts. It's a very rosy view of history.
Well, as we know from Marx, the tradition of all dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living. Everybody's using a usable past. It's always there.
That's true.
But there's an extreme amount of dishonesty at work here with these people, evasion dishonesty. I wanted to read just for a second from the end of this Jacobite thing. It says, a growing proportion of the American people are quiring out for the swamp to be drained of its crooking factions and for the state to reify its multitudinous song of American greatness. Nationalists will adopt policy prescriptions only insofar as they meet that end, and if nationalists happen not to have any sensible policy prescriptions at their disposal, they will surely default to the exceedingly less sensible strategies employed almost a century ago by their European forebears. So that's a little complicated. But what they're saying is, if you don't give us a pretty good contemporary idea of what the nation state is composed of, what binds people together, not just these words, not just these assertions, oh, for sure, it's just going to be fascist. Oh, for sure, it's just going to be racial nationalism. You know, it's sort of a threat. It's saying, if these new nationalists don't have something real, something based on history, and based in people's real longings, then all the ground is ceded to the white supremacists.
I think the people at this conference would say they're in favor of civic nationalism. But that gets us back to in some ways it raises more questions than it answers about the past, about what traditions matter, about what specifically you're holding on to. And there are some answers they might be able to give, but also it's one of those terms that just, okay, so you're not a racial nationalist, you're a civic nationalist. Well,
fine,
but let's talk about what that means. Let's go down.
Yeah.
I do think this demand for more particular language gets at something. I guess we very briefly touched on this, which is kind of from the perspective of the left, what to make of this.
Yeah, what's the challenge?
And because I do think, for all the criticisms from the right, I do think the language of love, of particularity, that someone like Reno or Hazzoni was talking about, it is rhetorically more effective than I think some of what you sometimes hear on the left.
Yeah.
Or that it has the potential to be a really powerful political message. Because talking about families and communities and neighborhoods and raising kids, these are powerful messages, I think, politically. And especially when it comes to, we know among younger people, people in their 20s and 30s who want to get married and have kids, whether you're on the right or the left, I do think it's a known thing that given student debt, given wages, given the kind of broader economy, starting a family and raising kids is hard. And if one of the things that came out of this conference is harnessing the language of nationalism to the end of family formation, raising kids, healthy and strong neighborhoods and communities, and given everything that's going on in the country, from the opioid addiction to, again, the broader economy, I actually think this is a pretty good message for the right.
Yeah.
And it's not just talking about free markets, or consensus. It's better than the dead consensus.
Yes, I think that's right. Yeah, like we can and ought to maintain our thoughtful criticisms of the patriarchal family, of the ways that capitalism operates in the process of social reproduction, all of these things. We should keep them in mind, and we should maintain them, and we should seek to build a world where they aren't operative. But at the same time, these are powerful messages because people live in communities with familial bonds. They live in religious community. But one thing that drives me nuts about this is that it seems to me that the right really commandeers this language of community and solidarity unjustifiably, because they actually support more of the policies that create, that generate the inaccessibility of a comfortable life in which a person has leisure time and the option to spend time with their children instead of working all the time. They support all those policies. And even these nationalists, like even Josh Hawley, like he doesn't support unions, he doesn't support a minimum wage. And in fact, like the left's tradition is a tradition of community and solidarity. The left's tradition is people can't do it by themselves. We need to work together in order to topple hierarchies, in order to redistribute power, in order to win safe conditions in our workplaces. That's the left tradition. And the thing is that there's a critique, and we've touched upon it, that the left only talks about material demands. That the left is saying is, you'll get a minimum wage, that'll be nice. You get this money, you get that money.
Healthcare, this, that.
Yeah. Yeah. But that the left doesn't talk about what that means for people and what that means in their lives. I think some elements of the left actually do talk about that quite a lot, and it's totally dishonest of these people on the right to say that the left, the proper left, doesn't talk about that stuff. Like a union organizing drive isn't successful because somebody makes one really compelling argument about how you're going to get a raise. Union organizing is successful because people start to rely on each other, they trust each other, they build family-like bonds amongst their coworkers, and they take a huge risk together. And it's a very beautiful thing, and it absolutely mirrors the kind of, you know, communal sacrifice and communal working together that the right says is so rare in American life now, and that we should strive for. That's what the left does. Like, we build social movements where people who didn't think of each other as brothers and sisters before now do, and it's just dishonest and frankly infuriating that the right has been able to some degree to monopolize this language. But also that they pretend like there isn't an existing tradition in the United States that prizes community, that prizes solidarity, that prizes collectivity, but which is also not racist.
Right. That's a good point, Sam. And I think this is where use the word dishonest. I think one way this plays out in terms of political rhetoric is that because the left thinks trans people should be treated with decency, or that gay people should have rights, the right turns that into a zero-sum game, right? That if you're for gay people getting married, or you're for trans people being respected and their dignity being recognized, that you're somehow against the traditional family, or
yeah,
the so-called traditional family. And because the left is concerned with people on the margins, rhetorically that ends up being used against them. So the dishonesty is just that, while there are people on the left who are rigorously critical of the hierarchies that are entrenched in certain institutions, or, you know, critical of the patriarchy, that doesn't mean you're against fathers per se.
Yeah.
and there are people on the left who realize that if you have a different healthcare system, or you have a different kind of economy, that will help families. It'll make it easier to have kids and raise them. And just because you don't think everyone should have to, or just because you're not preoccupied with birth rates or natalism, it doesn't mean you don't care about these things. I think sometimes the left could lean into some of that rhetoric more, because I think there's sometimes a fear that if you lean into that too hard, you'll come across as a social conservative.
Yeah.
You know, so I think the left might be able to do a better job talking about this sometimes, especially at the electoral level. But overall, it just, you know, it's very frustrating, because as someone who is very religious, as someone who grew up a kind of social conservative, one of the things that made me move left was the realization that I think as a matter of justice and as a matter of helping people, these economic programs that the left holds forth are the way to go. But also that actually, even if you are a social conservative, a lot of the problems that we're dealing with are because of capitalism.
Yeah.
And whether it's the opioid epidemic, or even just the kind of demands put on parents, you know, the way they have to work, the way they can't spend time with their kids, you know, that's all, these are problems that confronting capitalism in a way these national conservatives don't seem to want to. actually would go at least some ways toward helping or obviating.
I do think we should try to address head-on the challenge posed by the right in terms of what constitutes the nation and borders, right? Because part of what makes the task easier for the right with these national conservatives is that they get to say, not only do we care now, suddenly, do we now care about, you know, creating the material conditions for your family to flourish, but we care about you and we don't care about them. We care about you and we don't care about the people flowing over the border. And we don't care about these refugees trying to come in and undermine our country. And we don't care about people on the other side. On the left, they care about them. And in fact, they care about them more than they care about you. That's the rhetoric we see increasingly, right? The left wants to give free healthcare to undocumented people, but you don't even have healthcare, or you don't have good healthcare. But the left wants to give government healthcare to these people from outside of the country. Yeah. This is a real challenge, right? So how does the left respond to that is my question.
Well, that's a difficult question. The advantage the right has is that I do think when we talked about Rusty Reno's speech, and he quoted Cardinal Newman, who's going to be beatified this fall, actually, by the Roman Catholic Church, that you have to love your friend before you can love sort of people beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
I do think there's a way in which, in terms of political psychology, the right has a bit of an advantage, because in just the same way that I would help you, Sam, as my friend, or I would help my parents or my sister or, you know, people close to me, It is true that the level of political psychology, there's something more tangible and particular there.
Yeah.
And so the right's playing with very real tendencies and impulses that I think we have. And this is where some of the kind of left populism stuff is interesting, because I think you can point to the way in which, you know, us and them.
Yeah.
How will that line be drawn?
Right.
For the nationalists, it's us as existing Americans who are already on a certain side of the border,
yeah,
versus the people outside. So it's kind of an inside-outside thing. Whereas I think the left, you know, the us and them is us is the 99%. Or
the global working class.
The global working class. And the them are the bosses and the capitalists and the financiers who exploit us.
All of us.
And so I do think, like, looking forward, in terms of how the left responds or how the left might think about the question of the nation, I do think it should involve some soul searching about rhetoric.
Yeah.
And I think it mitigates toward leaning into the different left us and them dichotomy. But I also think, and I don't know, some people might disagree with me on this, maybe even you do, Sam, to some extent, but I do think the left, there's a rich language of, the left has a history in the United States too. And for as much as the right wants to claim that history, I think there's a beautiful and wonderful history of dissenters and egalitarian democratic figures throughout
Radical
American
Republicans.
History. And, right. I mean, and this is the abolitionists, the people who fought for a minimum wage or a 5-day work week or an 8-hour work day, whatever you might say. I don't think the left should cede the language of patriotism or the language of American history to the right.
We have a usable past also.
We have a usable past too. And this is, I'm simply channeling Richard Rorty's Achieving Our Country, where he talks about this and gives some examples of what the left might point to. But I do think that's something, I think in the left's often justified refusal to, you know, paper over the darker moments of American history, I think sometimes that leads toward a posture toward American history that doesn't fully use it to the left's advantage.
Use our own history
yeah. And use the elements of American history that represent what's most noble and best about our country and our aspirations. And, you know, that was something that Dr. King did in a way. And it's something that various social movements throughout American history have pointed toward. And we have the advantage of, for all the ugly and nasty parts of our history, you know, enshrined in our documents are still lines like, all men are created equal.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I do, for me, I think that was one takeaway, is that the language of the right that was expressed at this National Conservative Conference was powerful. And I think one effect on the left should be to sharpen our own rhetoric and remind us that we have a usable past too, that we shouldn't cede American history to the right, and that some of those notes are really worth hitting when we argue, when we propose, when we make our case
for what the
American people, for what America is and what it stands for. I think there's a way you can do that kind of undercuts some of what's going on the right. And it doesn't mean you're conceding anything to the right. It means you're recognizing that people do have particular loyalties in a kind of first order sense, but that doesn't mean that's where it has to stop.
Yeah.
There is a kind of, I almost want to say, a kind of internationalism built in to the best of the American tradition.
Yeah. Look, I mean, the American labor movement is the result of this crazy commingling of immigrants from all over the world in cities like New York, exchanging ideas and learning each other's languages and finding a way to work together to fight the boss and fight the forces of capital. Like, that's the American experience and the American experiment, and that's our history. So I totally agree.
And, you know, my Italian grandmother, when her parents came over from Italy, what democratic experience did they have? You know, what experience of the Anglo-American tradition did my Italian grandmother have when her parents, you know?
Yeah.
None. You know, my ancestors didn't destroy the United States because they came from a place with a shitty government.
Yeah.
You know, that's why they came here. Yeah. That's the other thing. Some of the most patriotic and decent and generous and loving Americans have been people who escaped the kinds of cultures that had horrible backgrounds, but that made them appreciate a relatively free and democratic system of government all the more. So kind of marking people forever by what country they come from strikes me as just ludicrous.
It's ludicrous. And the same is true today, right? Like, people are coming to this country from places where, for whatever reason, they are unable to flourish, right? And that's it's just not different. It's the same. Yeah, on the question of patriotism, it's complicated, but I tend to agree with you, and I don't
want to portray this as an uncomplicated question either.
I don't think we have. I mean, one way to talk about this is like in the sense of there's these potent symbols, there's these potent signifiers, which if the left rejects them altogether, the right gets them all. Like, in a sense, like, the meaning of the flag, the meaning of America, the meaning of patriotism. We should remain rigorously critical of the parts of that history which are, as we've talked about many times, coterminous with white racial hierarchy, the oppression of women, and boots on the necks of working people. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't, in certain instances, for strategic reasons, utilize those symbols for our ends, for our own ends. And it's one way to think about it, and this is also the Richard Rorty thing, but it's political malpractice to concede all of that to our enemies.
Yeah.
We can simultaneously tell a story about America that's compelling to the vast majority of people, and that's more compelling than the story that Josh Hawley is telling, and at the same time maintain rigorously internationalist principles.
Well, on that note, this might be a good time to wrap up. But before we do, we mentioned at the start of this episode that we'd started a Patreon, that we have literally thousands of new listeners over the last couple of weeks. And that's been in part due to the generosity of some of our friends. So we want to mention them to you, give them shout outs. Some of our friends are the hosts of the Trillbilly podcast.
Oh, yeah.
That Sam was on, and they've been...
The Trillbillies is actually the only good podcast. Stop listening to this podcast, go listen to Trillbillies.
I have to admit, I'm a relatively recent convert to the Trillbilly podcast, and it is very good, or at least I love it.
Trillbilly Workers Party is the whole thing, and they have a Patreon. Support their Patreon, support our Patreon.
Yeah, but they've been generous in plugging us and saying we're a cool podcast, and So we want to thank them, and if you like us, you'll probably at least like some of what they do too.
Definitely.
And Sam, what was the
Max Alvarez?
Max Alvarez, yes.
Max is a really great friend, a great thinker, writer and editor, and he hosts a podcast called Working People, which is genuinely lovely. And Max has also been plugging us left and right, which we really appreciate. Right.
He was recently on the Citations Needed podcast, I believe, and mentioned us, and that sent a number of listeners our way. So we want to thank them.
Listen to Max, Working People, support their Patreon too, but really support our Patreon. So this was a long, involved conversation, but
it was worth it. It was a topic that really, I mean, a conference on national conservatism is, it doesn't do it justice to say it's in our wheelhouse. It's thinking about this and explaining it and grappling with it is one of the reasons we started the podcast. And as we said, there'll be some announcements coming up in the weeks ahead, some big announcements. And we hope to have some guests on soon. But stay tuned, because there's a lot going on. Things are picking up on our end. And as soon as we know more, we'll share that with you.
Yeah, support the Patreon, rate and review. There will be bonus content if you do sign up for the Patreon. And we just genuinely appreciate the support, because this is fun for us to do. It takes a lot of work, but we love it. And thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
And at a bus stop off the county line, smoking beneath a for sale sign, watching all them cars as they roll on by. They disappear on down the road, heading for nowhere, I suppose. But sometimes I wish I could tag along. It's alright, it's okay, it's just another wasted day. Life is just another thing to bring you down. So punch out and get stoned, it's just another. My hometown.